This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Uhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Our message to any actor seeking to exploit this conflict is don't do it.
That's John Kirby, Director of Strategic Communications for the U.S. National Security Council, repeating the Biden administration warning to armed groups to stay out of the fight between Israel and Hamas. Details coming up. Also, Britain's King Charles III and wife Camilla are in Kenya for a four-day visit. And Washington has removed four African countries from its AGOA program. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight.
Just as the United States would not agree to a ceasefire after the bombing of Pearl Harbor or after the terrorist attack of 9/11, Israel will not agree to a cessation of hostilities with Hamas after the horrific attacks of October 7th.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who yesterday rejected calls for a ceasefire in Israel's conflict with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Today, Israeli ground forces are attacking Hamas militants and infrastructure in northern Gaza as warplanes strike across the sealed-off territory. More than half of Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinians have fled their homes, with hundreds of thousands sheltering in schools or hospitals. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 8,500 people have died since fighting began on October 7th when Hamas militants attacked several Israeli communities. More than 1,400 people in Israel have been killed, most of them civilians, slain in the initial Hamas attack. In addition, the militant fighters took more than 230 hostages from Israel into Gaza. Israel soldiers yesterday freed one of the captives, a female Israeli soldier. Netanyahu also urged the international community to demand that the hostages abducted should be freed immediately and unconditionally. Also today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken testified in the U.S. Senate that the Biden administration is pushing to get at least 100 aid trucks into Gaza a day. Israel has blockaded the enclave and its residents are short of food, fuel and medical supplies. United Nations officials say hundreds of trucks a day are needed. At the same Senate hearing, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said he has made clear to Israel's military leaders that they must protect civilians in Gaza. Reporter Linda Gradstein is closely monitoring the situation from Jerusalem, and she's standing by to brief us. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you so much.
So, Linda, first, let's talk about Netanyahu's remarks that he will not agree to a cessation of hostilities.
Yes, he gave a speech in English, so it obviously was meant for the foreign press and for, the international community, saying that it would be like, the United States agreeing to a ceasefire with the Taliban after 9/11 or agreeing to a ceasefire with the Japanese after Pearl Harbor. And he has said that the goal is to eradicate the Hamas military power. And that fighting has continued. Israeli troops and tanks have pushed further into Gaza. We have reports just a few minutes ago, by the way, of two developments. One is that two Israeli soldiers were killed in that fighting, and the other is that in an Israeli airstrike in northern Gaza, 40 members of a family were apparently killed, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, in a direct hit on a residential building.
And Netanyahu was the big news. Like yesterday, he was also asked whether he would step down as prime minister over Israel's defense and intelligence failure ahead of the Hamas attack.
Yes, he said the only people who will resign will be Hamas will resign. He has said he does not intend to resign. There are, however, growing calls from, all across the Israeli political spectrum, including quite a few former Netanyahu supporters. While the heads of the intelligence and the former chief of staff have taken responsibility for the real catastrophe of what happened on October 7th when thousands of Hamas gunmen breached the border from Gaza and really took over 20 Israeli communities and have said, I am responsible for this, for whatever happened. Netanyahu has said only that there will be an investigation and everyone will have to give answers, including me, but he has pointedly not taken responsibility for his role. He also, there was kind of a little controversy a couple of nights ago where at 1 a.m. he posted a tweet saying, I was only informed of this in the morning after it happened. I didn't know anything about this. And there was such a public outcry that he ended up taking down the tweet and sort of apologizing for it. But I think there is a growing sentiment that he will not be able to stay in office. But at the same time, what he said and what a lot of people do say is that in the middle of a war is not the time to have these conversations. It's after the war ends, whenever that will be.
And Netanyahu also has urged the international community to demand that more than 230 hostages abducted by Hamas should be freed immediately. Tell us about the current status of the hostages.
Well, we don't know much, actually, except, as you mentioned, there was this one female soldier who was freed in an Israeli operation yesterday, and there were some very emotional scenes of her reuniting with her family, especially her grandmother and people in her neighborhood, cheering and celebrating. And so I think that was kind of a ray of light after 3 weeks of a very difficult time here. At the same time, there was a very interesting video put out by Hamas on a Telegram channel of three women who were being held hostage, and in Hebrew, basically blaming Netanyahu for their situation and yelling at him to do more. Now, Israel has dismissed that video as propaganda, says that Hamas is just trying to use psychological warfare against Israel, and none of the Israeli television channels or many of the American ones have played that video. I did see it, however, and the women look in good health. Only one of them is speaking, the one in the middle, but they seem to be in good health, as was the Israeli soldier. So I think that gives people some hope that, most of the hostages have been, treated okay in captivity, and as opposed to the horrible things that happened when they were captured and taken into Gaza, once they were actually put wherever they are, which many believe seems to be underground tunnels. There have been, besides the soldier, four hostages released, two elderly women last week, and one of them said that she was kept in a room with a couple of dozen other hostages. She was treated well. She was given medicine, food, what she needed. So there's hope that most of the hostages are still alive.
And lastly, Linda, how about Gaza? Citizens there left without access to clean running water, food, medical supplies. Even the internet, I understand, is out, or is it back?
No, the internet now is back, although it's quite weak. I've tried to do, Zoom interviews with contacts and friends in Gaza, and the internet is just not strong enough to support it. But it is back somewhat, and phones are working again. Over the weekend, Israel apparently cut off everything. Israel is allowing more aid into southern Gaza. It has told all the residents of northern Gaza that they should flee south. And there are something like 50 trucks between yesterday and today. However, human rights organizations say that several hundred trucks are needed. And Israel continues not to allow fuel into Gaza, saying that fuel can be used by Hamas to fire rockets. So it will not allow fuel in. It also says that Hamas has stockpiles of fuel, and people should, if they need fuel, should go to Hamas. However, recently, a few hours ago, Antony Blinken said that as far as the United States and Israel know, none of the humanitarian aid that's gotten into Gaza so far has been taken by Hamas. So I think there is a sense that Israel is going to allow more aid to come in. However, the situation in Gaza continues to be desperate. And as the Israeli ground invasion advances, you know, which is backed by an air invasion, it seems, you know, almost inevitable that there will be more Palestinian civilians killed as there were today.
Reporter Linda Gradstein, closely monitoring the Hamas-Israeli crisis from Jerusalem. Thank you for your input.
Sure. Thank you.
Britain's King Charles has begun a four-day visit to Kenya, his first trip to Africa since becoming king following the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth, last year. Addressing aspects of Britain's colonial past issued related to the climate crisis, education, and the importance of national security will top the monarch's agenda. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Madialo has the story.
The royal visit kicked off with a welcoming ceremony at the State House led by Kenyan President William Ruto and the country's First Lady. It was followed by a visit to Uhuru Gardens National Monument and Museum, a new location dedicated to telling Kenya's history through Kenyan voices, where the king laid a wreath at the tomb of the unknown warrior. Right after, King Charles and Queen Camilla went to the Eastlands local library, where young and old lined up inside to greet the couple. Joel Aluoch grew up in the area and couldn't believe the king was paying a visit to the library he's known for so long.
This is very phenomenal. We are so elated to be in the group or entourage that is going to meet the king, His Majesty the King. It is a lifetime experience. It's so happy that he actually chose to come to Eastlands, where we are born and bred.
VOA also spoke to a few other attendees, including Eva Aholi, Rahma Abdi, and Lucy Vihenda, who were lucky to not only see the royal couple up close and personal, but even shook hands with them.
I feel great. It's a privilege to greet a king and a queen. I feel special.
I feel happy. And I tell them, Jambo, welcome to Kenya.
It is a privilege and honor, first of all, to see the king and the queen and to shake their hand. And we wish them well. Tell them, Karibu sana Kenya.
The last phrase means big welcome to Kenya. This is the third foreign trip for the royal couple and their first to Africa since Charles became king last year. Kenya holds a symbolic significance for Charles' family because of what it represented for his late mother, who was in Kenya when she learned her father had died and she had become queen. This trip comes as the African nation celebrates 60 years of independence from Britain. Javas Bigambo is a Kenyan lawyer and a governance specialist. He recalls Kenya's hard-fought struggle against British colonialism.
There was the issue of picking up or taking up the land of the locals when Kenya was a British protectorate from 1901. Through the time of the struggle for independence, the Mau Mau struggle, where a number of Kenyans suffered in the hands of the British.
10 years ago, Britain apologized and agreed to pay compensation to thousands of veterans of the Mau Mau nationalist uprising in Kenya, which was brutally suppressed by the British colonial government in the 1950s. In Kenya, Mau Mau veterans and campaigners welcomed the apology at the time, but said the compensation of about $3,500 per victim was not enough for the pain, suffering, and long-term effects the community endured. Other groups have also been asking for an apology and reparations. On Monday, the Kenya Human Rights Commission sent a 10-page document to the UK High Commission in Nairobi with its demands. Davis Malombe is the group's executive director.
We are raising a number of concerns with respect to the unresolved injustices by the colonial government when they were in the country, of course, between 1895 to 1963. And also the other atrocities which have been committed by the British multinational corporations and other actors from that time to date.
VOA reached out to the embassy for comment, but have not heard back. King Charles and Queen Camilla will spend 2 days in Nairobi and then 2 days in the coastal city of Mombasa, where they plan to meet with environmental activists, conservationists, artists, entrepreneurs, veterans, and young people. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Israel's 4-day ground assault on Gaza has killed thousands of Palestinians in response to the Hamas militant group's stunning October 7th attack on civilians that left about 1,400 Israelis dead. But as Israel brings the fight to this tiny crowded strip of land, officials from Washington, Moscow, Tehran and Ankara are weighing in. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
The White House says it welcomes the limited flow of humanitarian aid and the restoration of telecommunications in Gaza as Israel continues its ground offensive on the enclave in response to militant group Hamas's October 7th attack. The Biden administration also is repeating its warning to armed groups to stay out of the fight. John Kirby is Director of Strategic Communications for the National Security Council.
Our message to any actor seeking to exploit this conflict is don't do it. And as you all know, we have strengthened our force posture in the region. We're continually watching to make sure that any actor who might be tempted to jump in here knows that we will take very seriously our national security interests in the region, not to mention our obligation to protect our troops and our facilities that are going after ISIS in places like Iraq and Syria.
But this conflict is also exploding in the court of public opinion. Hundreds of people stormed an airport in Russia's Dagestan region over the weekend, shouting anti-Semitic slurs over the arrival of a flight from Tel Aviv. Russia's president blamed the events on foreign interference, a move Kirby dismissed as classic Russian rhetoric. Here's Russian President Vladimir Putin. The events in Makhachkala last night were inspired, including through social networks, not least from the territory of Ukraine, by the agents of Western intelligence services, Putin said.
The events in Makhachkala last night were inspired, including through social networks, not least from the territory of Ukraine, by the agents of Western intelligence services.
And Turkey's president has dug in on his disagreement with the U.S.'s classification of Hamas as a terror group and has shifted blame elsewhere. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The West has the biggest responsibility for the massacre in Gaza, he said.
The West has the biggest responsibility for the massacre in Gaza.
Iranian officials have piled on as well. That nation's foreign minister took to the rostrum at the United Nations last week to outline their view. Iranians have also protested on the streets. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian.
It has been 3 weeks that we have been witness to the war crimes and genocide of the occupying Israeli regime in Gaza and the West Bank of Palestine. The United States and several European countries have sided with the occupying regime of Israel. Without observing the UN Charter and international law,
Kirby says the White House believes there's a fine line between disagreement and discord, and says the administration is vigilant over outbreaks of anti-Semitism.
No, we believe in the right of peaceful protest, even if it's, you know, espousing ideas we don't agree with. Nobody wants to see peaceful protest turn violent or turn dangerous the way that this mob activity did in Dagestan yesterday. So it's of concern, and it's something that we'll continue to talk about with our allies and partners.
But it's also something that increasingly the White House is facing at home, as protests, many supportive Palestinians and critical of Israel, have bubbled up at major U.S. universities in recent weeks. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. U.S. President Joe Biden is getting ready to drop Uganda, Gabon, and Niger, and the Central African Republic from a special U.S.-Africa trade program called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA. Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council and former U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel region, says the four countries are being expelled from AGOA for one or more reasons.
When Congress legislated and created the African Growth and Opportunity Act, the AGOA system of trade preferences for sub-Saharan Africa, there are three criteria written into the law with broad bipartisan support. One was the country had to be making reforms toward a market economy, liberalization, and transparency. Secondly, the country had to respect the rule of law, including, obviously, not having unconstitutional changes of government and not carrying out human rights abuses. And thirdly, the country should not be undermining U.S. foreign policy interests or national security. So those are the three criteria for eligibility. This is not a trade agreement. This is a trade concession of benefits to African countries, allowing them to export goods without tariffs. And that gives them a heads-up advantage. In Gabon and Niger, because they had unconstitutional changes of government, it goes with the recognition by the State Department that their coups have taken place. Central African Republic, the human rights abuses, including those carried out with the implicit and sometimes explicit sanction of the government by the Wagner Group and other Russian mercenaries, is well documented by human rights groups. And then Uganda, following upon the advisory put out by the State Department about its anti-LGBTQ plus legislation that was signed into law earlier this year.
A law that imposes the death penalty on people found guilty of engaging in certain same-sex acts.
Yeah.
But this is a big deal for these countries, right, to be dropped from AGOA?
Well, in absolute terms, perhaps not as big, but certainly in reputational terms, it's a big deal. For example, the Central African Republic exports to the United States less than $1 million worth of goods a year. So really, even with tariffs slapped on, I don't think it's going to affect the surrounding area in terms of international trade. Likewise, the Gabon, perhaps bigger. I mean, there we're dealing with last year about $220 million worth of exports to the U.S. Niger, again, large sum, but not that big, about $73 million. Uganda, it's up there with Gabon, about $174 million worth of exports to the U.S. But I think for these countries, much more importantly, is the signal it sends that you've been removed from a system of trade preferences. You're somehow, if you will, no longer have the good housekeeping seal of approval.
Some of the countries that we have not talked about were expelled before. Burkina Faso, Mali, Guinea. Why were they dropped?
Again, unconstitutional changes of government. They all had coups, which, raises an interesting issue. Congress and AGOA was passed back in the Clinton administration, renewed in the Bush administration, renewed in the Obama administration, and in fact is up for renewal next year in the U.S. Congress with wide, broad bipartisan support. But Congress had a consensus on three criteria: market reforms, not engage a rule of law, and certainly not having coups. But the third one is the one that I think bears a bit of looking at, which is the one that Congress insists that the countries that benefit from this should not do anything that undermines U.S. foreign policy interests or national security.
That's Ambassador J. Peter Pham, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam, in Washington. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Vondi, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.